wanted to talk about the two truths and how to understand the two truths. And this is mostly because of a place of confusion that we got to at our Wednesday meeting. So I wanted to go back over that territory. But I'm going to do that in a very odd way, because I'm going to do that by telling a Zen story. And I'm going to go back to my favorite Zen character, who's the sixth patriarch, who I talked about with the flapping pennant. Remember that? So I'm going to go back to that guy. And for some reason, I have a special affection for him. And presumably, he existed. There might be some debate about that. But anyway, I think he probably did. His story is recorded in something called the Platform Sutra, which is full of all kinds of layers of history and fantasy and everything else, and contradictory information. And that's because he lived in the 7th century. And so all this information about him, you know, was accumulated over centuries. And so there's something probably in there that's very pithy and true, but it doesn't really make any difference to me from the point of view of what I'm going to share with you, what's true or not true, because it's still, you know, interesting and valuable. So as a young man, he felt the need to visit a certain monastery, which was the monastery of the person who's known in his historic sense as the fifth patriarch of Zen. And at the time, he was known as a lineage holder, I guess. But anyway, he was a great teacher, and he was very well known in China. And so it's not surprising that this young man would want to go visit him to study. So when he gets to the monastery, as is typical, you have to meet with the abbot. You can't just walk in and say, I'm here, I'm going to hang out, give me a room and something to eat. You have to have an interview with the abbot. And so according to the story, he has an interview with the abbot. And so I'm going to mispronounce his name in Chinese, because I can't pronounce Chinese, but the way his name is spelled, it's Huineng. I have no idea how it's truly pronounced. So Huineng says, you know, makes his greetings to the abbot. Huineng's from the south, and the abbot is more or less from the north. And so the abbot asks him why he's come, and he says something about being enlightened or wanting to be enlightened. And the abbot says, you're a southerner. You're a barbarian, because China had just been expanding into the south at that point. So people from the south were not considered civilized, and they weren't really Chinese either from the traditional Chinese point of view. So you're a southerner. You're a barbarian. How can you achieve Buddhahood? And Huineng says, northern or southerner, all have Buddha nature, doesn't make any difference. And then according to the story, the abbot was going to say something about this, and he looked around, and there were all these people, and he said, you know, okay, you're admitted. Somebody will tell you what to do. I'm not going to talk to you about this now. I'm making this up as I go. That's not literally what's in the sutra. The sutra says something else, but I mean, it the sutra says this in a pithy way, is what I'm saying. Yes. I'm not making it up like a fantasy. I'm just saying, you know, I'm putting it in my own vernacular. There you go. So anyway, he gets a job in the monastery, pounding rice or something like that, and he's there for, I think it's 8 months. At which point, the abbot says to everybody in the monastery, I want to transmit the authoritative teachings and to someone who will then become the next abbot of this monastery, the next lineage holder. You all have been practicing. So what I want you to do is I all want you to share your understanding with me. And whoever expresses the correct understanding will receive, and the way it's phrased is the robe and the bowl, because those are the symbols of authority or direct transmission of the abbots. So everyone retires, and the senior student in the monastery decides that he's going to express his understanding in the form of a poem. And according to the stories, there was an area in the monastery where which was being prepared for a painting was going to be made. And so the head student, who is the senior most student, writes a poem of his understanding. And he does that in the middle of the night, because according to some stories, he's kind of modest and, you know, he doesn't want to stand out and he's not really sure of himself. So he writes the poem, but he doesn't really tell anybody that it's his. He doesn't sign it or something like that. And the next morning, all the monks in the monastery get up and they see this, and they're looking at this and they're buzzing around. Wow, this is really incredible. But the abbot has something else to say about it. So here's his poem. This is the poem that the head student writes. The body is a Bodhi tree. Bodhi means enlightenment or awakening. The body is a Bodhi tree, the mind a mirror bright. Take care to clean it carefully and let no dust alight. I'll repeat that. The body is a Bodhi tree, the mind a mirror bright. Take care to clean it carefully and let no dust alight. The abbot comes by and he sees this and he says, well, if you practice this way, if you practice in this way, you won't fall into a lower rebirth, but you won't get enlightened either. So this is good, but it's not good enough. So everybody go back and think about this some more, and whoever wrote it, try again and see if you can do better, because it's not good enough. So Hui Ning is in the audience, and so everyone goes back to their rooms to think about this, and, you know, what does this mean? This sounds like a good thing, you know. So take care to clean it carefully, let no dust alight. And I'll explain what this means in a minute. And then the middle of the next night, Hui Ning sneaks into the corridor, actually, according to some stories, where this painting is going to be made. And he writes, the Bodhi tree does not exist, nor does the mirror bright. Since everything is empty, where can dust alight? I'll read it again. The Bodhi tree does not exist, nor does the mirror bright. Since everything is empty, where can dust alight? The next morning, everyone comes out and looks at this and they're thinking, what? What is this? And the abbot comes out and looks at this and says, call the artist. And the artist who was going to, you know, paint in this space, maybe a mural or something like that, comes and he says, thank you very much. We don't need your painting after all. We have some poems here. Here's your fee. Goodbye. But according to the story, he knows who wrote the second poem. And he finds him and he says, come to our room this evening. Don't tell anybody you're coming, though. And then they have a very long conversation. And they talk about the Diamond Sutra, which is one of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And as the scholars point out, up until this time in the Zen tradition, the main sutra that was being studied was the Lankavatara, which means the Descent to Lanka Sutra. And Lanka is Sri Lanka, for what that's worth. Now, I won't go into the difference between these two sutras. It's all interesting stuff, but not necessarily relevant to what I want to talk to you about this evening. But he says to Huineng, you got it. They don't. You're the next patriarch, but you've only been here for a little while, and if I tell everybody you're the next patriarch, there's going to be trouble in the monastery. So get out. Go hide out for a while and practice and deepen your understanding, which doesn't make any sense in a certain way. But you are the next patriarch. Here's the bowl on the road, and split. And then he has various adventures because everybody figures out what's happened anyway, and then they're pissed off and they chase him, and various things happen. So the point is, though, what's the difference between these two poems, and why is this relevant to the two truths, which is really what I want to talk about. The key to this is in the abbot's commentary, that if you practice in accordance with the first poem, you won't descend to a lower rebirth. However, that the true understanding, the deepest understanding, is in the second poem. And so here's what the deal is. When the head student writes, the body is a Bodhi tree, the mind a mirror bright. He's talking about the relationship of mind and body, and specifically saying that the body, and I've always taken it to mean the body as an energy system, because the Bodhi tree, although Bodhi tree technically means the tree under which the Buddha was enlightened in Bodh Gaya, I always think that the Bodhi tree refers to the inner channels and energies of the body. And it's like the the spinal column and the nerves are like a tree, you know, inverted tree. And that's what's being referred to here. And the mirror bright, of course, is the mind. And in Zen, what you're practicing to do is to make your mind still and calm and perfectly reflect what's going on in the world, without the interference of thoughts and negative habits and stuff like that. And so that's the reference to take care to clean it carefully and let no dust alight. Because the idea is you're constantly practicing to cleanse the mind and keep it clear. And that involves a lot of practices that are associated with collecting merit, for example, like reciting sutras, making offerings, like mandala offerings, as we would do in the sadhanas that we practice. Or simply doing the practice of meditation and keeping the thoughts from obscuring the reflective mind, which is the bright mirror. And so this is the great practice of meditation at the time, which was cleanse the bad habits, halt the activity of the mind, so that the mind can clearly reflect the true reality, both the internal reality and the external reality. And that's why the abbot says, if you practice in this way, you won't fall to a lower rebirth, because you'll be collecting a lot of merit, you'll be keeping your mind pure so that negative habits overcome you, and therefore you'll have a more positive experience in this life and in the next. And that this is traditional religious practice. This is certainly traditional Buddhist practice. But the abbot says, but it's not going to get you enlightened. It's going to improve your condition, but it's not going to free you totally from the cycle of birth and death. It's not going to enlighten you. It's not going to reveal your Buddha nature, which is what he had the conversation with Huineng about when Huineng first showed up. And Huineng says, doesn't matter whether I'm a barbarian or a civilized Chinese, I'm still a human being, and as a being, I have Buddha nature. So it doesn't matter. And, you know, that which in itself was a pretty radical thing to say. I mean, if you think traditional Chinese society was highly stratified, as we know traditional Chinese society, you can imagine what it was like, you know, 1400 years ago, 1500 years ago, highly stratified society. And, you know, here's this, quote, southerner who's not even considered probably entirely human from the point of view of the Han Chinese perspective. But he understands that Buddha nature has nothing to do with that stuff, that every being has it, including the insects, for example, although they don't talk about that. His poem, however, Huineng's poem, says, "The Bodhi tree does not exist, nor does the mirror bright." Now, it's easy to take this in a nihilistic point of view, like it doesn't exist. He's saying is they're empty. Okay. The Chinese translates it as does not exist, but what it really means is that the body is empty of inherent existence, of solidity, of permanence, as is the mind, which is what it means to say that the mirror doesn't exist. It means it's empty. And some translators have actually said that. Since everything is empty, so that's the reference, where can dust alight? Because if in the nature of things, they're empty of all the obscurations that are associated with belief in permanence and if the essence of things is not permanent, is not autonomous, is just what it is, irrespective of our thoughts, there's no place for obscuration and negativity to exist. In other words, everything is pure from in its very nature. And again, in the sadhanas that we recite in Tibetan, the mantra is Om Svabhava Shuddho Sarvadharma Svabhava Shuddho Aham. Everything is empty and pure in its essential nature. So you find this in all the Tibetan sadhanas. So what's happening here is the difference between understanding the conventional truth of things, which is that everything is interconnected, and therefore you have to take care about the consequences of things because things are connected. That's polishing the mirror, keeping it clean by recognizing the consequences of everything that's done. So what the poem of the head student is about is saying, I understand the conventional reality of things, that everything is connected to everything, and everything depends upon everything. Therefore, I understand that what meditation is about is cultivating and cleansing the nature of awareness and the nature of mind and the nature of experience and habits so that there are positive outcomes and positive habits, which is what comes from accumulating merit. But the teacher is saying that that's not enough, that simply understanding the conventional nature of things will not get you enlightened. It will keep you from being reborn in negative states. In other words, from our point of view, we could say it will provide a wholesome state of mind, but it won't liberate you because it won't show you the ultimate reality of things. Because the ultimate reality of things is just what they are, is their emptiness. And that's what Huineng writes about when he says, mirror, you can't polish the mirror. It was never dirty. How can it be dirty? Because in its essential nature, it's always pure because it's empty. The same with the body. If you see through all of these things into their actual nature, then you don't really need to be concerned about accumulating merit. You don't need to be concerned about accumulating demerit, because neither is real at that level. Now, of course, both statements are actually true. Both statements are actually true, because in the conventional reality of the way things are connected with each other, we do need to practice positive behaviors and positive states of mind and positive outcomes. We do need to accumulate merit. We do need to see how things are connected with each other. But if you're sitting in deep meditation on the emptiness of things, where there are no phenomena that stand out as apart from anything, because you're meditating on the emptiness of all, the emptiness which has one taste, as the Tibetans would say, all things, then it's not possible to accumulate negative habit patterns because there's nothing there to engage with, to have a negative thought about, to interact with in a way which is either connected or non-connected. And all these teachings that you find in the Chinese and Japanese traditions, where they talk about know this, know that, know the other thing, nothing exists, this doesn't exist, that doesn't exist, this is what they're referring to. They're not saying that nothing exists at all. What they're saying is that in the state of the emptiness of phenomena, in the state of their ultimate truth or their absolute truth, they don't have a separate existence. And in that sense, they don't exist because we only perceive things when we can create separations. But at the same time, everything on the other side of the coin, on the flip side of the coin, the conventional reality of things, everything appears and needs to be treated in a certain way. The appearance needs to be treated in a certain way, which is to understand the consequences of your interactions with things, and therefore to polish the mirror, if you will. So on the one hand, you polish the mirror, and on the other hand, you know that there's actually no mirror there in the most fundamental sense. And that's the way the two truths relate to each other. That's why they're both truths. The absolute nature of things and the conventional nature of things, when seen as true, both are true. They don't contradict each other. So we live in a world of appearances, and we have to treat the appearances with a certain reality, respect, and delicacy. And at the same time, we understand they're mere appearances, and they don't have a fundamental, ultimate existence. So, I don't know, you know, if this helps or not, but as I said when we had our last Wednesday meeting, I kind of went into this a bit because it's so important to understand. It's very easy to fall to the extreme of thinking that one point of view is true and real and the other one is not. They're both important. They're both true. Okay. That's all I have to say tonight. Would you like me to say something else?
Yeah, I do. Why don't you say a little more? Just because I don't think Steve or Brian were here last time, were you? No. Could you talk a little bit about the Guru Yoga again, just briefly? Because I'm going to lead off the meditation with that. Again.
Guru Yoga?
Yeah, just a little bit about it.
Okay.
The context. I mean, he did a good talk about it last time, so if you want to hear it online.
Guru Yoga.
Switch gears.
Switch gears. I can hear the gearbox like like this. You know, that's a hard transition to make from Huineng and poems to Guru Yoga. When the early scholars began to examine Tibetan Buddhism at the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of them actually didn't think of it as being much like Buddhism. There was so much stuff they saw that didn't look like Buddhism, because they were used to seeing Buddhism as sort of Thai Buddhism or Burmese Buddhism, something like that, which are in the Theravada tradition. They didn't really know what to make of what they were looking at. They pretty much didn't understand that it actually went straight back to the monastic universities of India, which were destroyed in the 12th, 13th centuries with the Muslim invasions. Really undid them. So there were a number of things they saw in Tibetan practice that didn't make any sense to them, which had a lot to do with the Vajrayana tradition that we're in, and images like this, which seemed pretty weird to them, didn't seem very Buddhist. A lot of scholars referred to Tibetan Buddhism as Lamaism because of a phenomenon they saw of the way the Tibetans treated their teachers. And they didn't think of it as being very Buddhist, so they didn't even want to call Tibetan Buddhism Buddhism, so they called it Lamaism, which you know, in context and historic perspective, demonstrates the unbelievable lack of understanding these people had, even though they were scholars, which those of us who are scholars in the early 21st century can learn a lot from in terms of having limited understanding when our ancestors were so ignorant and considered themselves so smart. There's nothing to assure us that we're really much any different and get right down to it. Anyway, all of that aside, in a sense, they got something right, which was what they got was the Tibetans truly understood the important role of the teacher in Buddhist practice, especially in Vajrayana practice. And what that role is, which is critical and which presumably is the reason the king wants me to talk about this, is that the lama, the teacher, if they're a true teacher, if they're truly an advanced teacher, somebody with a high level of attainment, the teacher has, because of that attainment, because of their intensive practice, realized, if you will, to use that kind of language, or actualized their own Buddha nature. I mean, they're in touch with it. Their Buddhahood expresses itself through them. So for those of us who are kind of regular, ordinary Joes, you know, we all have Buddha nature. I mean, that was the point of the Huineng story. We all have Buddha nature, but we don't see it. You know, we live in the world of appearances. We don't live in the world of the actual nature of things, both from the point of view of what we see externally, but in this case, more significantly, from the point of view of what we experience internally. Nobody in this room experiences themselves as a Buddha. I'm quite sure of that. I think that that's pretty safe to say. At least I don't. You know, and I'll make some assumption that you don't either. You wouldn't be sitting here listening to me. I'd be sitting here listening to you. You know? So it seems reasonable to come to this conclusion. But that doesn't change the fact that we all have Buddha nature within us in some way. I mean, how that is could be debated, but it's there. But the real teacher is somebody that spends time, you know, as a Buddha, in the sense that they spend time in their deepest nature. That's a real teacher. That's the truest kind of teacher. And if you meet somebody like that, then basically what you're doing is, and it's appropriate to treat them as a Buddha. Now, because of the situation with the two truths, maybe they're only a Buddha when they're meditating. And when they're not meditating, they're kind of, you know, some irascible old guy. But when they are meditating, they're Buddhas. You know? So the Tibetans understand that. And so, you know, you could be meeting the irascible old teacher, but you know deep down inside, he's still a Buddha. So that's how you treat him. And that's what your attitude toward him is, which is not ordinary. It's very devoted, because you recognize the profundity of what this person is. And in fact, you know, what the person represents is that which you're trying to achieve. So if you treat them with reverence, and if you understand them to be the living expression of everything you're trying to achieve in your own practice, you would venerate them. And you would understand that if, for example, the main practice that you were doing, that they were doing, was green Tara or Yamantaka or something else, if you wanted to know what a realized Yamantaka practitioner was like, or what a realized green Tara practitioner was like, if you wanted to see what's it like to meet green Tara in human form, that would be the teacher, because that's what you yourself would be seeking to achieve. So you would venerate that kind of person. And in the sense, you know, the scholars were sort of correct if they wanted to call that version of Buddhism Lamaism, but they kind of missed it nevertheless. So Guru Yoga is the meditation practice in which you recognize that the teacher is the essential thing that you yourself are trying to become. Moreover, actually, I could go back to the Huineng story. One of the things that the fifth patriarch says to Huineng when he says, you are the sixth patriarch, you have achieved the lineage, you're going to carry the lineage. He says, transmit this teaching directly from mind to mind in the future. That is in the Platform Sutra of the sixth patriarch. So what does this mean, to transmit the teaching directly from mind to mind? And that kind of idea has been carried forward in Zen teaching. You hear this in Zen monasteries. The transmission of the lamp from light, from mind to mind, is something that they would say. Well, what it refers to, as far as I can determine, is that the teacher's mind or awareness or understanding or realization is something that you experience firsthand in their presence. That mentally you connect with them. I mean, I hate to use the word telepathy because it gets a pretty bad rap in the modern Western world, but what I really think they're talking about is essentially a telepathic relationship between the mind of the student and the teacher. And that the essential practice of guru yoga is putting your mind in relationship to the mind of the teacher. I mean, that's what I do every day, is try to remember that my teacher is somebody with great realization, and his mind is something which stretches beyond anything I can understand and is not limited by the ordinary boundaries of time and space. So if his mind isn't limited by the ordinary boundaries of time and space, why would I think that he's not here with us now? As a matter of fact, when we met the Wednesday before last, was it the Wednesday before last? It was. Yeah. When we met the Wednesday before last, as far as I'm concerned, he was in the room when we were doing the teaching. I mean, I felt him in the room. You know, I mean, nobody else did, but I certainly did. So that's the practice of guru yoga. Is that what you wanted?
Yeah, basically.
Good enough?
So when we did the Yamataka initiation here a few weeks ago, one of the things that I found, it felt like the timing was right to open up to the guru yoga concept, and we repeated it. And then in this last group meeting that we did, we started out that way, the meditations that way. And I think that there was a way that it really brought an incredible, you know, like energy into the room. And when David's talking about, when we're talking about doing guru yoga, we're not talking about David and myself. We're talking about somebody who's more realized than we are, and you can visualize it as the Dalai Lama, or you could, you know, you have another teacher that you feel that way about, or even Shakyamuni Buddha. You can do that. The being who's referred to within Guru Yoga is called Vajradhara, which is kind of like the first manifestation Buddha out of, you know, emptiness and consort. So you can just visualize it as Vajradhara too. And it's just a way of just establishing the relationship with that mind. And again, of course, in reflection of your own Buddha nature, too. So you will be doing that. And I think, to go pull them off the porch, you may have gotten an email that I have the Guru Yogas on the porch all week for people to pick up. So I have extra copies out there. And anybody else who, you and Steve, and anybody else who hasn't picked one up, one of those, and to take home. And look at, David introduced the very short version last time, and I tend to like a version of the longer version. I don't quite do the whole longer version either. So we'll be doing that tonight.